Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for the Tech Guy is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com. Hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. I got to start the show, get going here. This is the show where we talk about computers. No, it's not gardening. The internet. No, it's not cooking. Home theater. Yeah, we do that. Digital photography. We talk about cell phones. Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Security. All that stuff. Anything with a chip in it, I'm here to talk about. I'm a geek, but you don't have to be. We talk in plain English whenever possible. And I think if you just listen to the show, it'll all become clear. You'll be a geek eventually. I think that takes a couple of years of solid listening, though. Just give me a few weeks. That's all I ask. We have a great website. I invite you to visit techguylabs.com. It's free, no charge, no subscriptions needed. That's where you'll find, of course, the phone number, but you'll also find our chat room, which is a great place to go to get extra help or just to hang out with the smart kids in the back of the class. We also have all the questions, all the answers, every show, audio and video, going way back when. And that's one of the things I like to do is that we put audio and video and a text description of each question, question by question, answer by answer. So if you hear something, you can go back and hear what I said. And I hope we'll add your 2 cents worth, too. We've got a comment box there. And that's really valuable. Always free, always open, 24/7, Tech Guy Labs. .com. Couple of stories I want to talk about before we get to the phones today. Let's start with the fingerprint reader. Of course, iPhone 5S, the new iPhone, has a fingerprint reader, as we expected. There are some issues to think about before you use it. You don't have to use it. I will point that out. And there are cases, if you're up to no good, you might not want to use it. Now, the first thing people wanted to know, and the first thing Apple said is, no, we don't send your fingerprint to the government, to the NSA. We don't even store it. It doesn't even come off the phone. There's no image of your fingerprint being saved at all. And now, while we can't prove that, I trust Apple on this, and it's exactly how I would do it if I were Apple. When you first put your finger, and it'll take, I think, up to 5 different fingers, either 5 of yours or 5 different people. When you first put it there, it reads it, and you know it shows you a little fingerprint and starts to fill it in, asks you to do it a couple of times because they're looking at different angles, and then finally says, good, I've got it. Now, it's not storing an image. It's storing what we call a hash, which is they process it a little bit to give a unique number. That unique number is generated by the whorls and pits on your fingerprint. And it is presumably relatively unique to you. Contrary to popular belief, I don't think every fingerprint is unique. There may be many duplicates, or at least many that would generate the same hash number, but it's highly unlikely that somebody else would also have your phone. So it's apparently very effective. Everybody's used it, says it's very effective, works very well. But there is something that nobody thought about until this thing came out, and I read about this on Wired.com, an attorney named Marsha Hoffman. She has a law practice specializing in security, computer security, electronic privacy, free expression, intellectual property. I've known Marsha for quite some time. She was a senior staff attorney at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, very smart. She's a fellow at Stanford Center for Internet and Society, adjunct professor of law at Hastings Law College in San Francisco. So this woman knows what she's talking about. And she said something I thought was kind of interesting about the biometric authentication in the iPhone. Now, there are a lot of advantages to this. If it's an accurate, reliable technique, then you know you could use it to buy things. In fact, you can buy Apple's stuff with it already. However, it has the legal effect of eliminating your right to the Fifth Amendment. Fifth Amendment of the Constitution guarantees, quote, no person shall be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against yourself. You have a right against self-incrimination. But Interestingly, recent court cases say that memory-based passwords, PINs, things in your brain are protected by the Fifth Amendment. That revealing them, if that revealed incriminating information, would be called self-incrimination. And by the way, the Supreme Court says this applies not just to criminal prosecution, but any proceeding, civil or criminal, formal or informal, where answers might incriminate us, including, and of course you remember, you know, taking the Fifth during the McCarthy hearings in front of the Congress, but it could also apply in a civil suit. For the privilege against self-incrimination to apply, the government has to try to force you to make a testimonial statement that would incriminate or tend to incriminate you. You have a privilege against that, and so no one, including the government, can force you to give that testimony against yourself. But apparently, the courts believe a testimony only is testimonial when it refers to the contents of your mind. So collecting blood samples, DNA samples, examples of your handwriting or your voice aren't covered. The government can say, hey, we want your blood. We want a DNA sample. You could say, well, it might incriminate me. They say, well, too bad. Guess what else is not protected? Your fingerprint. So this is an example, actually, the Supreme Court offered. If the police demand that you give them a key to a lockbox, and that lockbox happens to contain incriminating evidence, turning over the key is not testimonial. It's just a physical act. So that's okay. On the other hand, if you've got the same incriminating information instead in a wall safe with a combination, giving the police the combination would reveal the contents of your mind, and that's protected by the Fifth Amendment. Okay, hey, I'm not making this stuff up, kids. This is the law. So I think a fingerprint authentication is great. I think it's easier than trying to remember a long password. If it's effective, and I guess we're going to know because it's going to suddenly be in use by hundreds of millions of people on iPhone 5Ss, that's a good thing. And I'll use it. I think it's a great idea. But just want you to know, and this doesn't mean, hey, you know, you're Al Capone and the feds are trying to get you for tax evasion. It could be in a civil suit, somebody suing you and said, you know, there's something on that phone that would help my case. If the phone is locked by a PIN or a password, you're protected. They can't demand it. If it's just your fingerprint, they can legally say, put your thumb right there, and you have no recourse. What? Now, Apple doesn't do this, but Attorney Hoffman in her column in Wired does say, you know, if they did a fingerprint plus a PIN, that would count. That would be protected by the Fifth. I just, you know, the law is a fascinating and bizarre creature that has evolved over the years. Actually, this right against self-incrimination predates our Constitution and actually goes back to the 1600s. So this is a long-standing principle rooted in English law from way back before our Constitution. But, of course, they didn't have fingerprint readers during the Spanish Inquisition, so I don't think that they thought about this. And, interestingly, the Supreme Court has this kind of strange point of view about it. They can take your blood, even if it would incriminate you. They could take DNA samples. They can take voice samples, handwriting samples. They can take your fingerprint, or they can ask you to put your finger on a button, and that's okay. They just can't ask you for your password. Weird. All right, I can talk about that if you want. Just to be fair, okay, I'm out of time, but next hour, you say, no, Leo, don't be fair. I will be fair. There's a problem with Google we'll talk about next hour, just to spread the wealth, okay? Security issue with Google. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. I've got plenty of phone calls. No need to call in. We've got our calls lined up. Heather Hammond has done a great job. And we will get to those calls, answer your questions. And, of course, the website again, techguylabs.com. That's because I'm Leo Laporte, the tech guy. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy. You are? Well, let's – actually, I'm going to ask Heather, who should I who should I talk to? You get the power.
Andrew in Dayton,
better
who
you than
is
me.
In the chat room. I think you know him.
Maybe I do. I don't know the name. Let's see. Hi, Andrew. Thank you, Heather. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hello, Leo. This is Andrew from Dayton, Ohio.
Ah!
And we've talked before.
Okay. What's your chat room handle?
Andrew OH.
Oh, yeah. I'm always referring to you.
Yeah, it seems like it. Yeah. I love that. That's awesome.
Well, you know, what happens with a chat room, and for people who are first listening to the show for the first time, we have a chat room. It's through our website, techguylabs.com. And what happens is frequently the chat room will say something that's really useful, and I like to give you credit if I can, if I've seen the name. So thank you, Andrew.
Certainly, absolutely. And I'll do the usual pleasantries by saying I have been listening to you and watching you longer than the NSA has been doing the same to me.
That's a long time.
It is. And I may be wrong.
I think you may be wrong. That's right. They may have been doing it since time immemorial. Yeah.
Yeah. So my question is more about VPNs and encryption in email.
Okay.
And I've heard you talk about, you know, the whole situation a lot, also on Security Now, so on and so forth, other shows on Twit. But my question is, and I know you have a sponsor, ProXPN.
That's right.
And I'm sure they're great. I've actually checked them out a little bit. But how safe or useful is it to actually use a VPN?
VPN doesn't help you for email very much. So it's two different. So you have to understand what the two different things are doing. If actually, there's three if you include the anonymizer, the onion router. So a VPN is really for protecting you against local attacks.
Right.
If you think about it, because in order for the mail to go through, it has to be unencrypted at some point.
Sure, sure. But there's like point to point, like I have an encryption key and whoever I'm sending it to has a key on their side.
And that is effective. And as far as we know, although there are conspiracy theorists who don't believe this, but as far as we know, is impervious even to the NSA. That's using strong encryption. And fortunately, it's a very easy thing to do. In fact, I do it all the time, mostly because I just feel like the more chatter I throw out into the ether, the less effective the NSA spying on me will be, right?
I feel exactly the same way.
I guess that's kind of unpatriotic. I just, you know, because the NSA is trying to protect us against terrorism. They are collecting, we now know, pretty much everything that goes on electronically, all our emails and everything. And they're not necessarily reading them. They're reading them if occasion should arise. Unfortunately, we're learning more and more that there are NSA workers who are not particularly ethical, that they did, in fact, pass along, interesting phone calls between lovers and things like that. And so, it's offensive. And I understand the need for security, but it is offensive to collect my information if they don't have a warrant and they don't have reason to believe I am some way committing a crime. For them to collect, and they're collecting my emails and they're collecting my phone calls. We know that. And I have not committed a crime and I'm not under suspicion. So why are you doing that? And in fact, what they've said publicly is if you encrypt or use the onion router for anonymity, we're going to collect it because we're not sure what you're up to.
Exactly. And that's the big thing that I can't get past. And from what I've heard, and it may make me a conspiracy theorist, but I think the theories have been proven to be true. Even if you use like encrypted email that is strongly encrypted, they're still collecting that and will maybe go back at a later date to break that encryption.
The presumption is that they're collecting it for sure. The presumption is they may be able to someday unencrypt it. As it stands now, with all the technology that we're aware of, and I don't believe there's any magical technology we're not aware of, it would take them decades, if not hundreds of years, to unencrypt email using kind of standard encryption technologies. Now, the way this works and the way it has to work is we have to share some information. In order to send you, let's say I want to send you an email, Andrew, I need to get your public key. That's called public because it's okay to give it out. You might publish it on your website. You might send it to me ahead of time. The public key is safe to distribute because it can only do one thing, encrypt.
Right.
It cannot be used to decrypt.
Decrypt, correct. Yeah, right.
You have your own private key which can be used to decrypt, and you keep that under lock and key. You keep that safe. You don't give that to anybody. Because otherwise, it would give them. You need two things. You need the private key, but you also need this passphrase that unlocks the mail. And in order for you to unencrypt mail that I send to you using your public key, you'd have to enter that passphrase. If you lose a good long passphrase, You know, it still protects you somewhat, even if somebody gets your private key.
Right.
So, and then in order for you to send me, we have to do the same thing. You have to give me your public key. So really, the exchange of public keys is what allows us, you and me, to have a private conversation. And this can work for instant messenger. It can even work in phone calls. It can work in audio. And it works in email as well. We have to exchange public keys. Once I have yours and you have mine, then we can have a private conversation. And to our best of anybody's knowledge, nobody is able to break that private conversation without immense amounts of computing power, which, you know, they're not going to devote to all of us all the time. They can't.
Right. Like, bottom line, for somebody like me who just doesn't feel, for lack of a better word, safe on the internet, just, and I'm not doing anything wrong.
Well, here's what Steve Gibson, our security guy, says on Security Now. He said, because that's what police will always say. Well, if you're not doing anything wrong, what are you worried about? It's not that. It's that I do lots of things that are not wrong that I don't want to share with the public. I don't want the federal government to follow me into the bathroom. Thank you.
Exactly.
It's not. I'm not committing a crime. I just don't want to share that with them.
Right. And while I'm not doing anything wrong, I'm pretty sure those people are. Okay.
Well,
at least a few of them.
I respect what the president said a couple of months ago. He gave a press conference. He said, "Look, the law enforcement, these people are patriots. They're trying to protect our country. And I believe, for the most part, that is true. They're trying to protect us. But I also believe that there's a reason for a constitution. There's a reason for the Fourth Amendment against unreasonable search and seizure. We've got to balance it. We've got to watch the watchers. That's how our government works. And because of the secrecy, they have not been, there's been no oversight."
Exactly. Exactly. So if I want, like, say, half as much privacy as, say, a FISA court, do I go VPN and email?
Well, a VPN doesn't help you with privacy in the long run because the feds are tapping you all along the route, right?
Yeah.
At some point, it has to be unencrypted. The VPN protects you against somebody locally. So I use a VPN, for instance, when I'm in an open access spot or a coffee shop or in a hotel. That means anybody in the local area can't see what I'm doing. But at some point, it gets to the VPN server and then emerges unencrypted into the outside world. And at that point, the NSA or whoever's watching you can easily get it and probably does.
Right.
So the VPN doesn't protect you against the government. The only thing that might protect you against the government is PGP.
PGP, pretty good
privacy. It's encryption. Right. There's a number of ways to do it. I actually use the open source GNU Privacy Guard. If you're on a Mac, GPG Tools. If you're on Windows, GPG4Win, the number 4Win. They make it very easy. You'll create a key, and then you just send your public key out, or you put it on your website, or you get it to people, and that way they can send you private email. In fact, if you go to my personal website, leoville.com, you can get my public key and send me encrypted email, leoville.com. In fact, if you'd like to test your key, if you want to set this up, I'll be glad to do it. Oh, boy, I'm going to regret this. Leo at leoville.com, but get my key first at leoville.com. Hey, great to talk to you. Good questions. I really, really think this is important stuff. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Time to take some more calls here at 8888 Ask Leo. That's Ron in Kansas City on the line. Hi, Ron.
Hello, Leo. I was in your studios last year during the summer. I'm the Shriner from Kansas City.
Oh, yeah, of course. People may not know, we have open studios. You email tickets at twit.tv. You can come by and visit. And there's about, the radio studio is not very big, but maybe room for about five or six people. But I love having people come by and say hi.
Well, I've called to ask a fellow Mac user a question. Our motorcycle demo group that goes out in parades has asked me to help them produce a video that kind of runs in a loop that will also have still pictures in it so they can use that to show prospective new Shriners that this is a group they might want to get involved in. And I didn't know with what's already on the Mac if there's a tool to help do that or if there was something else that I would need to look to add to my collection.
Sure. So is this okay? Easy to, yes. iMovie comes on the Mac. If you buy a new Mac, it comes with iMovie, and it is a very good video editing program. You can insert video and stills. You can make a beautiful movie, but then you export it out as a movie. Does this have to go on a website, or what is the?
It would be on a DVD that we would have playing. We have a night when we introduce the members to the different groups.
Yeah.
It should be on a TV sitting there.
Yeah, iMovie will burn the DVD and everything.
Okay, so be able to run a loop and all that good stuff.
Yeah, that's the DVD player has to be able to do that.
Okay.
Not the DVD itself. The DVD player just has to know to keep playing.
Ah, okay. I was looking at it from the wrong perspective.
Yeah, yeah. It's just a plain old movie that just the DVD player keeps playing. Over and over and over again. This is great. So I always thought Shriners drove in clown cars.
That is some of the groups. I'm in one of the larger Shrines out in the Midwest. We have two separate motorcycle groups. We have Motor Corps, which is typically the one that will be in the parades that we go out to the smaller towns and do. And then we have Motor Escort that will escort dignitaries or do funeral escort.
Okay. And you don't wear fezes, or do you?
Typically, in those situations, they will wear fezes in the parades, but if they're out at regular street speeds, then they'll have to have the DOT helmet
on. You have to have a helmet. There's no helmet fez. Of course not. My grandfather-in-law was a Shriner. Somewhere I have his Shrine fez, and he was a grand poobah or whatever you call it. So it's quite an elaborate.
Right?
Yeah, it has a scimitar and all sorts of stuff on it. Quite an elaborate. He was a potentate. Love it. Very cool. Well, it's nice to talk to you. I'm glad we can help you out. I think iMovie is fabulous. Comes with all Macintoshes. And, of course, Apple also sells, if you get really sophisticated, and you don't need this, pretty much anything you want to do, you can do with iMovie. But for $200, you can upgrade to Final Cut Pro 10, and it's pretty amazing. That's a lot of professional editors use Final Cut. But iMovie, for most of us, I can use Final Cut. I like iMovie. It does everything I want. Everything I need. Good luck. Hey, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. DJ Las Vegas, you're next. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, DJ.
Hey, Leo. How you doing?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm doing good, but my TV's been doing better.
Uh-oh. What's the matter?
Well, you know, I have a nice 1080 plasma TV, and recently the HDMI inputs, all of them, the front and the back, all died. And
that's not good.
No, and doing a little research on Google, I kind of found out it's a bit common. And so it's kind of a big repair. It's maybe $500-$600 to repair. Yeah, yeah.
It's probably a controller that controls all of the HDMI, and if that chip blows, we're more likely short-circuited.
Well, you know, we had a lightning strike nearby,
there
and it
you
happened
go.
That night.
That's
so
it.
My question is, I'm expecting to, you know, I had to buy a component cable to hook up my PlayStation 3 now.
Right.
And it was a super downgrade. My audio was now So I'm getting my wife prepped to let me buy a new TV, and I'm asking, should I go 4K? I'm seeing them online now for real reasonable prices, and am I going to make a mistake if I don't buy one?
Should you go for what?
A 4K TV.
Oh, you shouldn't buy a 4K TV.
No?
No. There's no content. There's no 4K content, and there won't be for some time. I mean, one of the reasons you're seeing them is in order to do 3D, these TVs have to have the capability of doing higher resolutions because they're alternating screens. But there's no content. Now, you might say, well, gosh, you know, Leo, when the HD TVs first came out, there was no HD content. Look how quickly it came out. This is a little bit more challenging. I don't think this is going to happen in the next few years. And so you'll have something that, doesn't do anything that you can use.
I'd only be able to hook up my computer, and even then it would be trouble-ish. No.
Now, the PlayStation 4 and the Xbox One are going to be 4K capable, but I don't think out the gate. I think they will be capable, but you'll have to have content. And I don't know who's going to do that. So that might be, since you're a gamer, that might be a compelling reason.
I will buy a PlayStation 4. I am planning on it.
I ordered mine, too. So I wonder if... how much more expensive would a 4K be?
Well, you know, they have them on the popular website now. They have a 52 or 50 inch for about $1,135.
No, that's not much. Wow. Oh, yeah. That I know that one though. That's a junky TV. No. Don't get. Yeah, get a good, normal, good. You know, a Samsung, Sony, LG, Panasonic. I have a Panasonic Viera. I love it. Just get a good Panasonic.
Wait a minute. That's the one that just broke on me. A Panasonic Viera.
Oh, good. Thanks for telling me. I hope it doesn't happen to me.
Well, you live in a lightning prone area.
You really ought to have. Well, a couple of things. You ought to have a surge protector on your home theater components. They are sensitive to power surges. And when you're in a lightning storm, unplug everything. Because even if you have a surge protector, it'll jump right across it. So lightning will blow out more than your TV set. But they're all very sensitive to that stuff. So do not watch TV in a lightning storm. My suggestion to you.
Okay, thanks.
All right. Hey, yeah, no, I wouldn't get... by the way, this 4K, we use the term 4K, and that's probably incorrect. The term we should use is UHD or Ultra HD. The idea being that they are higher resolution than the new HDs. They're not quite 4K. 4K would be twice as much resolution horizontally and vertically, and the UHDs are not quite that. At some point, you know, we'll start seeing 4K content. The problem is you can't get it on a Blu-ray. It's too much data. So we're going to have to invent a new technology, a new physical medium. Probably, in fact, there's one called Red Ray that's probably going to be the successor at some point. You have to start putting movies on it. The good news is movies are generally produced at that kind of resolution, so that's not such a big deal. Sony sells a UHD TV set that comes with its own hard drive and player. You have to subscribe to get more movies. The other issue is I think physical media is going away. More and more we want movies streamed. Streaming 4K is very demanding. You need a lot of internet. I think we're still far enough off. There's going to be a point where it'll make sense to buy one. But at this point, I wouldn't spend a lot more money or make some sacrifices in quality to get UHD because you're not going to take advantage of it for a few years at least. I don't have it yet. I will have it probably, well, we'll see. Who knows? But I did order. Samsung has started shipping an OLED TV. Both LG and Samsung have them. I wasn't going to buy the LG because it was $15,000. But see, LG was smart because now they conditioned me. And when Samsung's came out at $9,000, I thought, wow, that's a deal. I bought it for you guys. We're going to look at it. We're going to review it. We'll give you some idea. I think the future of television probably is OLED. The screens are stunning. I've already seen them at the Consumer Electronics Show, and I can tell you, they just look gorgeous. And OLED, UHD is coming. See, that's the kind of thing that's going to be your next TV. Now get a regular HD TV. You'll be very happy. Plasma or LCD. Make sure you get LED backlit on the LCD. You'll be very happy. That's really the right way to go, I think. But there will come a time. I don't know when it'll be, a year, 2 years, 5 years, when we'll start saying, yeah, you want a future-proof. You want to get a UHD TV because it's coming. But not yet. 8888-ASK-LEO. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Next, your call. That's what's coming next. Stay here. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Heather Hammond answering the phones. We got another call coming in. On the Superphone, Mike in New All. You know, there is, by the way, Superphones. HD phones. Did you know about that?
And so you can see yourself really well if
no.
you FaceTime?
No. Sound quality. So T-Mobile, some of the cell phone carriers are starting to offer this. And the phone system we're using, the Telos phone system we're using, has this capability of HD audio. But because, you know, the way the phone, you know how the phone sounds like that?
Oh, yeah.
It doesn't have to sound like that. That's why Skype sounds so good. The reason the phone sounds like this, I think it's 6-bit sound. It's very low quality. And the reason they did it like that is so that they could push it down the line in you know, very adverse, low-quality conditions in 1920. We've come a long way. And so the capability, even on cell, exists now for much higher audio quality. But we've all got to agree on a standard, et cetera, et cetera. But we have this capability. We do now have this. And by the way, HD is not really, I think it's 8K instead of 6K. But it's a little better. And so anyway, our next call could be that way, but not today.
Back when the phone was on the wall and there was that earpiece.
Yeah, remember we talked about that, like, the long string? Yeah.
Mabel, get me Pennsylvania 65,000.
Wasn't so long ago. In fact, in the early days, they had to have humans do switching. That's why you would call the central office and the operator there would connect you. Physically, literally, take a plug.
Yep.
From your phone line, then plug the other end of it into the other person's phone line and make the connection.
That's rad. Lily Tomlin, is this the party to whom I'm speaking?
Well, we've all seen movies and stuff with those kinds of switchboards. They estimated around that time that if they couldn't come up with some sort of mechanical or electronic switching, that soon every woman in America would be a telephone operator in order to handle the traffic. It was not going to scale. And so they came up with mechanical switching, and now they do it, of course, electronically.
Hmm.
Fascinating, isn't it?
People lost jobs.
Phone history. Well, you're doing the same thing, ironically.
Oh my
God,
all
we got to do is get you some patch cables and you'd be Mabel. Mike in New Albany, Mississippi. Did you leave out the P there? M-I-S-S-I-S-S-I-P-P-I. No, it's all there. Thank you, Heather. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Leo. Good to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you. Thanks for calling.
Well, I did have, want to call you Dev, but that I've been listening for so long. But
nobody, that's my secret identity. Nobody knows about Dev Null. Oh, my gosh. Heather, did you know that I was once a virtual reality character named Dev Null?
I did, in fact. Oh. Someone was kind enough to send me a clip from YouTube.
Dear. Oh, dear. Well, Mike knew it, too. I guess my secret is out. Yeah, that was a long time ago on MSNBC when it first launched in the mid-90s.
And your co-star was?
Soledad O'Brien.
She's big.
Well, Leo, reason I called was I'm going to be making a trip up to Washington, D.C. in the Baltimore area. And I've been at, you know, I carry a cell phone. My wife carries one. We both have tablets. And what I wanted was I was trying to find something that could charge all the devices, just a single unit, instead of having, all these little separate chargers to have to deal with.
Oh, yeah, there are a number of things that will do that. We even have one here, but I think it's intended for commercial operation. What is the name of that, John? I know we have it right here. This you would put in a bar. I think it's intended to be in a bar or somewhere like that. And really, it's really very simple. This is a Charlie Charger, charliusa.com. And all it really is a big battery. And on one side, it's got all these connectors for different kinds of phones. So it's got two different lightning connectors. It's got a 30-pin connector. Those are for the older iPhones. And it's got two micro USB connectors. And you could charge as many six phones simultaneously. And really what it comes down to is how big is that battery? Because it's got to have enough juice. So you've got two phones. Are they? What kind of connectors are those phones?
They're both Samsung Galaxy S3s. But Leo, what I wasn't so much wanting a battery as I was something that could plug in the wall and like 2 amps to the problem is I'm finding ones that have multiple connectors, but like they're sharing a 2 amp charge rate. So
right.
If you put four things on it, the charge drops to almost nothing.
You're a smart man. So you understand that the phone needs a certain amount of wattage to charge up. And you want to give it the maximum wattage it can handle so it will charge in a reasonable amount of time. More watts is faster charging up to the limit. And how much watts do you get from a charger? Well, you multiply the amps times the volts. Now, all USB-based chargers are 5 volts. So really, the question you got to ask, and you've obviously figured this all out, is how many amps per USB connector can I get? And you want, what you'd like to get is a couple of amps each. So here's what I did. I bought one, and there is one exists, and it's from a company called Skosh. They make excellent stuff. It's on Amazon, S-C-O-S-C-H-E. It is 10 amps for each of the two ports. So it is the maximum wattage, 2 amps, 10 watts. It's 2 amps for each port. And that'll be enough for your Galaxy. In fact, it's more than your Galaxy needs.
Well, that's exactly what I'm looking for because, I have a Asus Transformer tablet and my wife carries the Nexus 7, and, they both need 2 amp charging
right.
for each one of those. So
yep.
It's that,
So this is for each plug, two USB plugs, each 2 amps. So that's about as much as you're going to get. I think you can't, drawing 4 amps from a single plug socket is probably as much as you're going to get safely. But you could buy a couple of these. They have fold-up prongs, which is nice. I got them for traveling. It works great. I use it all the time.
Well, that's exactly what I'm looking for. And can I ask you for about one other thing?
Yeah.
Another one of the people that called in was visually impaired, and that I am also. And this is something I don't feel like you would probably know personally, but maybe somebody in the chat room would have a line
sure.
on.
Yeah.
Is that I really love to use my tablet basically as a big phone. But the problem is the high-resolution screens that the tablet have on some applications, when you launch the app, it makes the text just tiny. I mean, I have to use a magnifying glass on some of them.
Right.
And if there was some way to trick the Android into saying, like, this is a big phone.
Text. Well, now, look in the accessibility options. If you have a Nexus 7, for instance, and you can change the font size to giant, and that might solve it for you. You should look at – have you played with the accessibility settings on your device?
I have, and I don't know if it's something to do with with the writing. Different apps handle it different
ways.
Well,
that may be. You know, a poorly programmed app is not going to pay attention, and that's really the bottom line. The app has to also support it, obviously. I would just say get a different app. What app are you using as a phone app?
As the phone app, I'm just using it on the S3, just the stock. But
you're using a tablet, not an S3, right? You want to use a tablet. So you need.
The launcher I'm using is the Nova launcher.
But are you using Skype? What are you using to make the phone calls on the tablet? Line 2? Tango.
I use a Samsung Galaxy S3 for the phone. I was just giving the phone as an example of the apps that you run on a phone. For instance, I use Yahoo Messenger to text back and forth with some friends.
And its text is too small, and it ignores the font settings in the settings.
Actually, that is one that they include a zoom function.
There's magnification as well in the Android. I think this is all solved with accessibility, unless an app is so rude as to just ignore what you've done in accessibility. But I'm looking at now this is Android 4.3. Maybe they haven't added it in earlier versions. But I'm looking at accessibility. This is 4.2.2. This is the Motorola X phone. I'm looking at accessibility here. There's magnification gestures, which will let you magnify the screen. There's a large text button. And there are settings as well in the display settings that let you change the font sizes. I think in general you should be able to make this pretty legible, unless you've got such a silly program that it ignores this. You see, here's the font size settings in the display. Small, normal, large, huge. And huge is pretty big. And I would expect applications to honor that. Yeah, they seem to. I'm looking at Gmail, Google+. It may be that you're using a phone app that doesn't. That would be a shame. I mean, what good is accessibility if the application ignores the setting, right? Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Don't take a break for your local news. More to come right after this. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hour 2 of the Tech Guy Show. Lots of calls on the board. We're going to get to those in just a second. But I said, you know, I was talking last hour about the weird kind of jurisprudence around fingerprint readers and why it might not be prudent, if you're trying to hide something in a legal case, whether civil or criminal, on your smartphone, on your iPhone, it might be prudent, might not be prudent to use their fingerprint reader. You'd be better off and better protected if you use a password or a PIN. At least when it comes to that, when it comes to the right against self-incrimination. But I also said I want to be fair. So we'll spread the wealth. We'll talk about Google a little bit. All right? This one just blows my mind. This is from a Computer World article, the column Defensive Computing by Michael Horowitz. Good column on security and so forth. And Michael has kind of a stunning headline. Google knows every Wi-Fi password in the world. What? Now, if this were true, by the way, it would have some impact because... Well, not only could Google use your Wi-Fi without your permission, but more importantly, Google could be subpoenaed by the feds. Or better yet, let's use one of them, their national security letters. That way Google can't tell anybody, and get the Wi-Fi password for a guy we're trying to investigate. Then we can get on his network. We can sit outside in that FBI surveillance van and not only watch his comings and goings, but we can look at his network and see everything he does online. Actually, this is a pretty good tool for law enforcement. And let me be clear, by the way. We talk a lot about privacy and the NSA and stuff. If it's being used with oversight against people who are you know, genuinely suspected of criminal activities, whether it's terrorism or bank robbery or whatever, I don't have a problem with that. That's called, you know, wiretapping. My problem is there seems to be no oversight anymore. There are no more warrants, and the NSA and others seem to be maybe overzealous in using this to do something called fishing expeditions. Instead of, hey, here, Judge, look, we have these reasons to think this guy is up to no good. Can we listen in on his Wi-Fi? They're just saying, well, let's listen to everything and see what we can find. That's not constitutional. That's wrong. That's a fishing expedition, and it's wrong. But because there is so little oversight, because this is all secret, you know, it seems to be the case that this is happening, and we just don't know how much. So here's the scenario that is a little scary in that, in light of that. Michael Horowitz writes, and you probably, if you have an Android phone, if you've ever switched Android phones, this is going to sound familiar. There's a checkbox. It's on by default, I think. I'm pretty sure it's on by default. I certainly turn it on if it's not. On every Android device, it's in the settings. Let me see if I can find mine. It says something like, would you like Google to back up your information? It's in the, is it in the backup? Yeah. It's in the backup and reset menu of my phone, my Moto X. Backup, app data, Wi-Fi passwords, and other settings to Google servers. Now, you can uncheck that, but it's really, really handy. In fact, if you ever upgraded to a new Android phone, signed in your Google account, and then all of a sudden, you're on the Wi-Fi, you didn't enter the password. Hey, that's cool. That's nice. Well, yeah. But think about it. How do they do that? Well, just as they say, they're backing up Wi-Fi access points, their names and their passwords, to the Google servers. And you might say, well, does that mean Google has them? Yes. And it's kind of complicated, the proof of this. But the fact that you can restore your settings automatically, unencrypted, not entering any special encryption, it means that Google, because Google knows your Google password, right? That Google, if they are asked, could say, oh, yeah, we know Leo Laporte's password. What about it? Oh, yeah. Well, yes, he's got password protected on our servers, all of his Wi-Fi passwords. Here's the good news. We know the password. So you want those? Okay, we'll give them to you. They can't not give them to you. By the way, this is not just true of Google. This is true of Dropbox, right? Does Dropbox know your password to Dropbox? Yes. If in any service where you're storing data, if that service knows your password, then they can see your data, right? SkyDrive, sure. We know that Apple's iMessage can do this because when you set up a new iPhone, you enter in your password and log into your iPhone, and all your iMessages go and fill up. Boom, there. So we now know that Google has stored on its servers in a way that it can be accessed every Wi-Fi password you've ever entered. Now, given that there are about 748 million Android phones this year in use, yes, I said 748 million Android phones, most of them are by default backing up passwords to Google. It seems likely. I mean, maybe it's an overstatement to say Google knows every Wi-Fi password in the world, but it's likely that it knows nearly every Wi-Fi password in the world. And by the way, even if you're not backing up, probably somebody using an Android device is on all the Wi-Fi networks you sign into, including your own, right? Do you let your mom or dad or your kids sign in? Are they using Android devices? I bet you they're backing up. But if they have ever backed it up, ever, at any time, they have a copy. So unless you change the password now, turn off that checkbox, change the password now, that people can get in your system. And if Google can get in your system, then I think it's safe to assume, based on what we know, so can the NSA, the CIA, the FBI, and anybody else who wants to. And by the way, tie this into the interesting revelations of a few months ago. Well, it was only a few weeks ago. That that the NSA spends a lot of money every year hacking people's computers. This turns out to be the easiest way to get a bad guy. Put a virus, a bug, a Trojan horse, a keystroke logger on his computer. He won't know it's there. You're seeing everything that's going on. And now this is really easy because all we have to do is phone up the Google guys. Hey, Google guys, I got a bad guy here. You don't even need a warrant. This is the problem. I got a bad guy here. What's his Wi-Fi access point password? Google tells you now, boom, the guy outside in the FBI surveillance van is on your network and can do anything he wants. It's kind of scary. I guess, you know, the response of the NSA and a lot of people is, well, just if you don't do anything wrong, you're okay. And you know what? I got to say this. I know we have a lot of law enforcement people listening. I know you guys are honest. And I know you guys have but one real concern, which is to protect the American people. And that is great. To get the bad guys, protect the innocents. And that is great. And I honor that. And I don't want to be the guy who says, hey, let's stop doing that. And then there's another 9/11. I certainly don't want to do that. But at the same time, we also, I think it's really important there be some oversight. And members of Congress seem to have just given up on that. We really need to pay attention to this. Put it all together, what we're learning is, A, there's pretty much anything that they want to know they can get. B, they seem to want it. And C, there's nobody, not a court. You know, it's a secret court that's watching them, and the secret court themselves say, yeah, we're not doing that good a job. Most of these requests are overreaching and broad. And Congress clearly doesn't care. Anyway, I just, you know, I wanted to be fair because the fingerprint reader I was talking about last hour, that's a problem. This is a problem. I think there's four ways to respond to this. One is to move to Alaska, the Unabomber method. Just get out, stop using credit cards, use cash. Two would be to give up entirely, kind of what I've done, and just say, well, whatever. They can get everything. That's life. I guess I'll have to trust them. A third way would be to try to technologically protect yourself. And I certainly do a kind of that. I use encryption on my email, stuff like that. We don't know how well that works. The fourth, and I think the best way for everybody, write your member of Congress. Let them know you care. We do. We care. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Your calls. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Taking your calls, talking high tech. Chris Marquardt coming up at the bottom of the hour, our digital photography guy. But meanwhile, there's still many people with many questions, including John in South Bend, Indiana. Hi, John. You're next. Leo Laporte here.
Hi, Leo. How you doing?
Hey, John. I'm great. How are you?
Well, I've talked to you before. You probably remember me, eh?
What?
I said, I've talked to you before. You probably remember me, don't you?
Sure. You're John.
Sure.
Yeah.
Oh,
who could forget John?
Anyway, I got...
Wait a minute, John, are you on one of those phones you got for subscribing to Time Magazine? Is it shaped like a football? Because you sound... It's a little garbled. Are you on a cell phone? What are you on?
I'm on an iPhone 5.
Oh. Bang that on the table a little bit just to clear out the microphone. I think it's the microphone. It's got a little spit in it. Just bang it on the table. No, I'm sorry. I'm kidding. You think you're going to buy the new iPhone? Are you up? Are you due?
No. Heavens no.
heaven for Fend. Are you the kind of person that buys a new phone every other year, or are you the kind of person that has to upgrade as soon as there's something better?
You got me tempted to buy whenever something catches my eye.
I know. It's sexy. I know.
If I had the money, I could buy it all.
That's the problem, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Yeah. Well, I buy them so you don't have to. I buy them all. I'll have the new iPhone. I'll have everything. It's what I do. It's a curse. It's a curse.
Okay, my question for you.
All right.
Is I have an older Windows Vista laptop. Ready to.
Okay, we now know the truth.
And I'm going to put Ubuntu on it, okay?
Good. That's a good choice.
Okay, and my wife has a Windows 7 laptop, and we have some pictures that we want to back up, that we've already backed up, you know, to the cloud, Google Drive, Dropbox, you know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Well, I'm looking for an external drive that would work for both of our laptops, and I want to know what you would recommend for me to buy.
So you need a drive that'll handle the Windows file system.
Yeah.
NTFS for anything from Vista on up.
Older Windows file system, FAT32, possibly. And you need to have it handle the Linux file system, which is EXT3, although there are other file systems. So that's a good question. Let's put it this way. Your Linux isn't going to have trouble with any of it.
No, I'm sure not.
But Windows is going to say, what's Linux? I don't know what that is.
Yeah, I know. That's the problem I'm worried about.
Here's what I would do. Format that drive to the lingua franca file system. That is the file system that they all understand. If you have any pre-Vista versions, pre-XP versions of Windows, that would be FAT32. If it's just going to be Vista 7, 8, plus Linux, make it NTFS. Actually, NTFS doesn't quite work as well as FAT32. You might want to just make it FAT32. Everything will work fine. Linux can read it. Windows, all versions of Windows can read it. In general, in fact, when you buy external drives, they're formatted that way. Even Macintosh can read FAT32. So it's just kind of the language. Macs have trouble with NTFS. I'm not sure how Linux does with NTFS. I think that's more Microsoft kind of keeping it proprietary than anything else. The only negative on FAT32 is that you can't get files bigger than 2 gigs. So your file size is limited to 2 gigabytes. So you're going to have to decide which of the two to use depending on size of files and whether other people can talk. R. Chandra in the chat room says, there are drivers for Windows to read the Linux file system. I think you're better off. Just, you know, use FAT32. When you get that drive, almost certainly it'll be formatted FAT32 because that's what everything understands. Jay, Providence, North Carolina. Hi, Jay.
Hey, Leo. I'm wondering if you know of any good routers which can help me to select the fastest DNSs around here, or if I'm going to have to.
That's interesting. Well, our good friend Steve Gibson has a program you can run to find the fastest DNS. I don't know of any routers that have that built in. Wouldn't that be nice?
Yeah, I've got a Mac, so that's why I was concerned. I mean, I'm aware of what you're referring to on the DNS bench.
Right. And that's probably what I would do. It doesn't change much. So once you figure out what's the best where you are. So let me explain what you're doing, because I think a lot of people are going, wah-ha-ha. So in order for the internet to work at all, you need a giant phone book. Because when you enter in an internet address like yahoo.com, google.com, techguylabs.com, the browser needs the equivalent of the phone number. It needs the IP address of that particular server. Now, you're not going to be expected to remember these IP addresses. It's like phone numbers. There's just it's too hard to remember. There's a lot of digits there. So what happens is when you enter techguylabs.com, your browser starts to ask around. It starts first by asking the operating system, do you know who techguylabs.com is? If the operating system does, it'll give it the address, and the browser goes on happily. If it doesn't, then it goes up the chain. It'll go next to your router. If it doesn't know that, then the router will query the ISP. If the ISP doesn't know, it will query its ISP all the way up to the 13 master phone directories, the master domain servers that are spread out all over the world. These are the big 13 that run the entire internet. So this is something you do every time you go online. You need to do these lookups. Not all, and this is called DNS, domain name system. Not all phone books are created equal. Your internet service provider's phone book, for instance, might be very slow. In some cases, it might be worse than slow. It might do some sneaky little things, like when you ask for a domain that doesn't exist, send you to an advertising page. That's not at all uncommon. So it really is worth at least once, and maybe you could do this every year. I don't think it's going to change much. Running a DNS benchmark. My friend Steve Gibson makes a very nice, simple one you can run. It's free. At grc.com. If you just Google DNS benchmark, you'll find it. You run it, and it will actually spend some time because it's going to query all the name servers until it finds the ones the fastest. And then you'll use that one. You probably want to use that in your router. But I don't know of any routers that do this for you. Maybe there are some.
Also, I think his only works for Windows, doesn't it?
Oh, yes.
That's kind of a limitation, isn't it? You're on a Mac?
Yes.
Look at this, Web99 in our chat room. There's one called Name Bench. It's for the Mac. And he's got a link. We'll put that in the show notes. Thank you, Web99. It's at code.google.com. It's also free. It does pretty much the same thing. It's an open source DNS benchmarking utility. You do want the fastest DNS server because the faster it is, the faster the web seems to be. Because, of course, if you've got a slow lookup, if it takes a while to look up a name, everything just waits. Have you had that experience? You open your browser, you type in yahoo.com, and it goes, waits a little, then finally gives you the page. That's the in many cases, that's the domain name server not responding promptly. So having a good domain name server is good. Some people use Google. Some people use Verizon. Some people, I use opendns.com. I happen to like that one for a variety of reasons. It's worth checking. Good question. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Chris Marquardt's here. Our photo guy, digital photographer extraordinaire. He does a great podcast called Tips from the Top Floor, tfttf.com. He also joins us every week from his studio in Germany, believe it or not. Is that why it's black and white today, Chris? Because you're all the way across the ocean.
Still black and white. Color must have gone lost.
All the color, yeah, it fell out in the ocean.
Well, remember last week we talked about black and white photography, so I hope some people shot some black and white pictures.
I love black and white. You've won me over on that one.
Good.
although, you know, I like to take full color and then make it black and white. I use a plug-in. This is, I guess, really we should have talked about this last week, from Nik Software, N-I-K Software.
Silver Effects.
Yeah.
There
it's really gorgeous, really beautiful.
It is good. Yeah.
So what do you want to talk about today, Chris Marquardt?
Well, this week I want to bust a myth, a photography myth. And if you go back with photography more than, let's say, 20 years, you will remember that the flash on your camera used to be kind of the boss, right? It used to be the light source that lit the entire room.
And we got so many crappy pictures as a result.
Well, as a result, you had lots of like white faces, black backgrounds. And the reason for that is that the light falls off quickly, right? It falls off by the square of the distance. So if you double the distance, there's only a quarter of the light. If you quadruple the distance, there's only a 16th of the light and so on. So the flash on the camera not being very strong, you end up with a very, very quick fall off. And also the problem used to be that the output of the flash could not be changed. So you had... You might remember flash bulbs. Yeah, you do remember flash bulbs.
I'm old enough. I remember flash cubes. I remember
the little Kodak cameras with the flash cubes on top that would rotate 90 degrees.
I remember you would buy flash bulbs. It'd be an individual. It would only fire once. Individual bulb. You'd screw it into a reflector. You take the picture, and you'd have to throw the bulb away and get a new one in there.
Well, and the way these worked is that those bulbs are little glass bulbs or maybe plastic bulbs, but they were filled with fine steel wool and oxygen.
Yeah.
So when you took a picture, what would happen is that the camera would actually ignite a spark inside that bulb, and the oxygen and the steel wool would go whoomp.
Yeah. I'm not surprised because the plastic or glass would be slightly melted.
It's like Stone Age technology. And it's like almost like hitting two rocks against each other, creating sparks here.
Well, nowadays our flashes are xenon gas, and they instant discharge. And if you have, sometimes they're LEDs on a camera phone.
And the problem used to be that you didn't have any control over these flash bulbs. They would fire at full output. The only control you had is when they fired, roughly when they fired. So the only way you could change the exposure of picture was like aperture, but you'd have a lot of output, and then the rest of the picture would go black and the foreground would go white.
Everybody looked like Al Capone in these pictures.
Yes. Yes.
So now do we have more control in a point and shoot? It feels like it's the same kind of thing.
Well, it's not. It's not, because with the electronic flashes that we use today, we actually have excellent control. Actually, the camera has excellent control. What happens today is it's almost like the camera takes two pictures. Now, remember, the physics of light have not changed. There is still the foreground and the background. There's still this fall off, so the light reaches the foreground but doesn't really reach the background. But what the cameras nowadays do is they meter for the ambient light, and then they fire a little pre-flash and they meter what comes back from the foreground. Remember that flash doesn't reach the background. So it kind of independently measures the foreground, your subject, and the background. And then it fires the flash just enough to light the foreground, and it leaves the shutter open a bit longer to allow light from the background to come in.
Wow, I didn't know all that was going on.
So it happens like within a hundredth of a second. You don't even notice that this all that stuff is happening because it's really, really fast. But this way, the cameras can now independently light the subject in the foreground with a flash and leave the shutter open long enough to light the background and get a kind of a much better balanced exposure throughout the entire picture, even though you're using flash. So that really has come a long way. It's called TTL or ETTL, or I think Nikon calls it ITTL. So these are very intelligent systems these days.
I have a what do they call those? You attach the top of your camera, little handy flash, and it does TTL through
speed light.
Speed light. It's Canon, so it does through the lens metering.
That's what TTL stands for. Yeah,
and that's great because then you never get too, flat. The problem with flash, as you said, is sometimes it makes everything flat and bright. But if you can modify it a little bit.
If you find that your pictures still are too bright in the foreground, you can even dial down the flash independently.
Oh, wouldn't that be cool?
So that's called flash exposure compensation. So you can make the foreground a bit darker. You can make the background a bit brighter if you like. So you have a lot of control these days. And fact is, the flash is not the boss anymore. It integrates with a very sophisticated system. It integrates into that whole system to light the background and the foreground.
I did notice, like the other day, I got a new Olympus, a tough camera. It's underwater and you can step on it and stuff. TG2 it is, and I did notice that it used fill flash intelligently, and I was really impressed. The image didn't look blown out. What is fill flash?
Well, fill flash is if you have very bright harsh sunlight. Let's say you are out in the bright sun.
We were backlit,
and you have.
And the sun behind us.
Even.
So when
your subject doesn't have enough light, the flash will kind of add just enough light to brighten up the shadows, to get some, to fill in the light. That's why it's called a fill flash.
It looked great because, we had the sun behind us, and normally you'd see the sun, the picture would be just a bright sun thing and us in silhouette. But the flash went off, and so you still could tell it was very bright behind us, but you could see our features, and I was surprised. It actually looked pretty good.
Using flash and bright sunshine these days is actually a pretty good idea.
What do you think of camera phone flashes? Are they any good?
They're pretty weak. I mean, those are LED based usually, so they kind of don't have the power that a real dedicated flash has.
And you see some phones now within the newer phones have two LEDs. Although there are some good Nokia phones that have xenon flashes.
The problem is the direction of the light, because it comes pretty much from where the lens is, and that gives you those red eye, and that gives you just light that is not very flattering.
Right. So flash is not all bad.
No, it's not. It's
just
mostly. Come a long way. Well, Chris, I still try to avoid it if I can.
Yeah. Chris, Mark, actually the best thing to do, and we'll save this for another day, but is to get the flash off the camera and over to the side, and then it can be amazing.
Yes.
If it's done properly. But that's more complicated. We'll talk about that another time. Chris Marquardt does workshops at discoverthetopfloor.com. We'll link to that and his own page and, of course, his podcast at our website, techguylabs.com. Don't forget, we're still looking for loud photograph. Can a photograph be loud? It's our assignment for the month. Illustrate the word or concept loud and upload it to Flickr, our tech guy group at Flickr. Make sure you tag it with the word loud so we know it's your submission. It's not a contest, not a competition. There's no prizes. It's really just an excuse to get out there and take more pictures. So trying to figure out what loud could mean, we're not going to tell you. You have to figure that out. Take some pictures, and you can upload as many as one a week for the next few weeks. And about 3 weeks from now, we'll do a review of three of our best pictures submitted to the Tech Guy group on Flickr, illustrating the word loud. What time? It's pretty late there, isn't it? It's almost like midnight?
Well, about 40 minutes to midnight. I'm an idol.
I'll let you go, Chris. Thank you for staying. Wow. Thank you for staying up late with us. ChrisMarquardt.com is the website. M-A-C-H-R-I-S-M-A-R-Q-U-A-R-D T. Can you take a few of those consonants out? It's really too many.
It's my parents.
ChrisMarkWartz.com. You know what? The easiest thing, TechGuyLabs.com. Thank you, Chris. We're going to take a break. When we come back, more of your calls. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888-ASK-LEO. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, and we are taking your calls, answering your questions. Our website, if you hear something, by the way, and you want to know more, the website has links. It's got everything you need. In fact, it even has the audio and the video of the show after the fact. You can go question by question. You can add your comments to my answers, which is really nice. I encourage you to do that. It will lower your blood pressure. I know that there are people who sit and listen to this show and yell at me. You don't need to yell at me at the radio. You can actually be heard by going to the website, techguylabs.com, and add your comments. And it's always free. There's no charge. There never will be. No subscription. I just want to make a database of valuable information, which in this case will include the question, my answer, audio, video, and text. But then if you add a comment, you say, oh, you know what? You should try this. Or, oh, Leo's wrong. You should do that. And the more that people do that, the happier I'll be. So please go to techguylabs.com. That's our website. 8888-ASK-LEO. Getting back to the phones. Ben is in Stafford, UK. Is it Staffordshire or Stafford in the UK?
It is actually Stafford, which is the county town in Staffordshire. So you're right on both counts, Leo.
I know nothing, but I guessed right. Thank you. It's good to talk to you. How do you like the new Doctor Who? Are you excited?
I'm probably one of the only people in the... to be fair, my guilty pleasure is Twit.
No Doctor Who for you, huh?
So I'm listening to the tech guy when Doctor Who's on. I've got no idea what's happening with Doctor Who.
You know, neither do I, but I thought that everybody in Britain just thought he was the greatest thing ever.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that Tom wouldn't be too happy with me. I gather from...
Tom Merritt's a big... He's a Whovian.
He really is.
Have you seen the weird Easter egg in Google Maps? There's an old blue, you know, the old blue call boxes in London. They're on Google Maps. There's, if you find the right one, it's right outside Earl's Court Station of the Underground. There's a blue box, and you can go into it, and it turns out it's not, in fact, a police call box. It's Doctor Who's TARDIS, his time travel machine. It's bigger on the inside than the outside, and you can look around. It is an amazing Easter egg. Obviously, somebody at Google is a big Doctor Who fan.
I shall have to go and look for it.
Even if you're not a fan of the show, it's worth seeing. So what can I – anyway, Glenn, Ben, I'm so glad you listen in the UK, and we really appreciate it. What can I do for you?
Well, I'm calling because the last person you spoke to, I'm tying all this together. I've got to say, Leo, I've listened to you for 18 months now, and I do web development, but I'm visually impaired myself, and I don't read web pages anymore. I listen to Twit.
Fabulous.
Much like Audible – and listening to books, I go off and I go for a walk, and I listen to 90% of your content. There's very few shows I don't listen to, and I feel completely informed. And you guys do such a great service. I'm so incredibly grateful. I feel incredibly connected. And as my sight has deteriorated over time, I feel still very connected to technology as a result.
Oh, my. I'm sorry to hear that. So you weren't born this way. You've lost your sight.
I've always been visually impaired, but my sight, I have quite a few sort of conditions. And so it's got a little bit worse with time, especially over the last couple of years. And so I can still read. I can still deal with things. The reason I called is to give a tip based on the person with the S3 that might help.
Ah, good. Thank you.
And I might also have an idea for something that...
So, I wasn't sure I understood his issue. He says that the font size is too small when he's using it as a phone.
The trouble is, programs like Skype, for example, don't actually increase the font size. The UI has to, the person that's coding it has to allow that. And even when you set it to be giant size text, when you go into certain emails, for example, all the text squishes up because of the way that it's rendered. So I understand exactly the issue. And so the tip is, unfortunately, you'll have to wait for it to filter through. If you've got a Nexus 7 and you get 4.2 or 4.3, there's a new accessibility option, and it does exactly the same thing. I've not heard anybody else talk about it, but I like to go in and dive into these things. And it does exactly the same thing that the iPad does, where you can triple tap and zoom in on the screen and pan around on the screen.
Yeah, I saw that setting in the accessibility options.
Yes.
Okay.
It doesn't appear to be on all phones, but that would be the best answer I can give him, because it doesn't really matter what app he's running then. He can then sort of pan in, read the text, move around. If he needs to, maybe invert the screen so that it's white text on the black background, if that's easier to read, and so on and so forth. And that will give you much greater control than any single app will do.
Ben, I thank you so much for helping us. So that it was as I suspected, which is that even though these settings are there, not all apps support it. Yeah. But that's the good news, that the apps do support the magnification feature.
It's system-wide, and so I'm purposely looking for my next phone to do that. I'm actually, I was wondering what you thought about the Samsung Galaxy Mega. I don't know if it's out in the US. It's certainly out in the UK, and that's a 6.4-inch phone.
So
it's
moly!
So it's like an S4, but even bigger than the Note. And it's very, very price-compatible. I mean, for you to order it from Expansys, you could get it for under $750, I'm sure. It's £450 on.
Yeah, I don't think it's available yet, but, you know, it's interesting. The success of the Galaxy Note.
Leah. It's now out. You can get it on the free network in the UK.
Yeah, I don't think we have it here is what I'm saying.
You've got it there. Yeah. Sorry, no.
You know, this is not the only giant phone. I think so far it seems that these companies believe, you know, for instance, the Samsung Galaxy Note Tabs have had phone capability in some countries.
They have.
Yeah, it's just not in the States. I think that they think that people in the U.S. don't want giant phones. I do.
I know you do, and my recommendation at the moment, Leo, is the phone that I have, which is a steal for the price on Amazon UK. I don't know if you can get it over there, but it's the Asus PhonePad, and it's £179, which is probably about $250.
Wow.
It's a 7-inch tablet, but it's a phone, and it will make phone calls.
I don't know how you get it in your pocket. That's the...
It just fits in like Nexus 7. If you've got a big pocket, if you're a big guy, it's not so bad.
Hey, Ben, it's great talking to you. Thank you so much for calling. I really appreciate it.
No problem. Anytime.
So nice to know you're listening in Stafford. Go visit the TARDIS. You can do it on Google Maps. It's just wild. So what is this? So phones of smart. First of all, it isn't a phone, is it? Let's just admit this right up front. It's no longer a phone. This all started because your phone, your flip phone, got smarter and smarter. It got a bigger screen. Apple in 2007 came out with the iPhone. By this point, it's not a phone anymore. It's a computer that you can make phone calls on, right? I don't know why we still call them smartphones. It's your pocket computer, right? That's what it is. Let's face it. And if you have a pocket computer, it makes sense. You'd want it as big as it can be and still be portable. I guess. I mean, you know, what do they say in the UK? Horses for courses. Whatever it is that floats your boat. I really fell in love with the idea of big phones using the Galaxy Note 2, which was a 5-inch screen. The Note 3 is out, and I think that's what it was at 5.6, 5.3. It's bigger. Well, actually, it's a bigger screen, roughly the same size, because they're shrinking the frame around the screen, the bezel. HTC One, which is one of my favorite Android phones, now is a giant version. I'm a little disappointed with Apple. I really was hoping Apple would maybe start to expand the size of the phone, although the truth is we kind of knew they wouldn't, because they have to continue to make compatibility. This year, they're doing it's a TikTok cycle. They're making a phone that has the same frame as last year. I wouldn't be surprised to see a larger phone from Apple next year. They've got to respond to this. Or maybe a variety of phones. Apple's always been one of those companies that makes the right phone, doesn't make a variety. Samsung's been the company that says whatever size you want. They have a Galaxy S4 Mini, they have a Galaxy Mega, and everywhere in between. And their tablets in some places have a SIM slot. But it's not a phone. I hardly ever make calls anymore. Do you? I'm curious. Do you use it as a phone? I mean, occasionally for emergencies, I do a lot of texting. It's certainly a communicator, but I don't make phone calls that often. So why not get the biggest screen that you can still carry around in your pocket? I mean, the iPad's too big for me. It's too big. You know, it's funny because, I've started using the Moto X phone, which you can finally get. And it's small. It's a 4.7-inch screen, which isn't that small. It's bigger than the iPhone. But if again, because they shrank the bezels, it fits in the hand. It feels like a normal-sized small phone, and yet does quite well. I guess the point is, let's all have choice. And if you want a phone that's 10 inches across, why not? Be my guest. 8888 Ask Leo. We're going to take a break for news at the top of the hour. We got lots more, though. Don't go away. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hey, Leo Laporte here, the tech guy, and the computers, the internet. We're talking high tech here. More of your calls coming up. Heather Hammond answering the phone. Thank you, Heather. Nathan Staton back at the home office, spinning the discs. He's our musical director. And, of course, you. That's a good team. Oh, let's not forget the chat room. Lovely little chat room. About 700 people in there, our great moderators, and everybody keeping an eye on things. Dan and I'll list them all. It's a long list. I'll tell you what, I'll put it on the show notes. Dan and CWBP. And see, if I start saying names, now I have to say everybody. I love our chat because it really is a way to give me feedback, to give me answers. That's really a help. Things like that. You guys. The chat room is kind of the smart kids in the back of the class mixed with the nerds who are throwing spitballs at me. It's perfect. So Tech Zen and Mick, Houdini 7, Life's a Zoo, Marmot, Rubicant, TTK, Canuck, Cheeto, CWBP, all of you guys. You know who you are. Did I leave anybody out? Probably. There's literally a dozen people in our chat room moderating it, and we have to do that, unfortunately, because there are a very tiny percentage of people who will make things unpleasant. And I want this chat room. I want this chat room to be perfect for you and your family, your kids, if you want. And it is. And so it's a lot of, hi, everybody. They're waving at me now in the chat room. Hey, I'm talking to you. Yeah. A lot of great people in there and a lot of smart people in there. So I've been doing this chat room thing ever since I started doing, call in computer talk. Back in 91. In fact, I've been doing this so long, some of the people who've worked as moderators for me have ended up being celebrities, like Robert Scoble, who've gone on to fame and fortune. Well, fame anyway. Maybe infamy. Chat room is a fun thing. I love the interaction we get from it. So get on in there. Go to techguylabs.com. Click the link, and you can join us in chat. You can also find on the website, you can find wonderful information because we've been storing the show notes there since 2004. So there's, answers to questions. If you hear something on the show, you can go to techguylabs.com. And thanks to James DeRuvo, who's my scrivener, who's writing this stuff down as I talk about it. You just go right there, and within a few minutes of me mentioning a website or all our chat mods, it'll all be up there. No, you don't have to put the chat mods' names in there. That's okay, James. After the fact, we've got Josh Windisch in my office. He puts audio and video to each and every question. You can go question by question. And your comments, too. And I hope you will do that. A great search engine there. If people have questions about anything, I hope they will find it at techguylabs.com. Always free, always open, 24/7. So I wanted to talk before we get back to the phone calls about some interesting news from Intel. Christopher Mims writing in Quartz, which is QZ.com, is a great online newspaper, by the way. I just love it for business news and tech news. QZ.com. But he's writing, Intel, he says, is about to do something that would have seemed crazy under previous CEOs. They're going to start competing at the low end of the microprocessor market. Intel has traditionally built the powerhouses, the best chips, and sometimes very expensive. You know, you can get a workstation chip from Intel, a Xeon, for $2,000 for the chip. That's not the computer. That's just the brains. $2,000. And that means they make a lot of money. They're very profitable. However, unfortunately, that market is shrinking. People are not buying high-end computers. They're not even buying cheap computers anymore, desktop computers. They're buying mobile devices. And the company that's doing the best in all of this is not Intel, but a low-power, high-performance company called ARM. And almost, as far as I know, every cell phone made uses a chip based on the ARM architecture, including the iPhone. All the tablets I know of, almost all, except for Microsoft's, you know, the Windows tablets, some of them use Intel chips, but most of them use ARM chips. Some use AMD chips. It's the less expensive stuff, and Intel cannot get into that market. And they want to because they realize that their bread and butter, their PC market, is just dying. They need to make small, power-efficient, inexpensive chips. So the new CEO at Intel, Brian Krzanich, who just replaced Paul Otellini, said something the other day that got people a little confluggled. He said that Intel chips will be inside tablet computers that cost less than $100 by the holiday season. Not only did he say it at the Intel Developers Forum on, I think it was September 13th, when he didn't get an applause line, he didn't get people on their feet cheering. I think they probably thought he misspoke. He said it again. Now, we see, Android tablets, cheap Android tablets. In fact, I tell you, you've heard me, to not buy them. They're crud. They perform poorly. They often break. There are some aimed at emerging markets, which are a little bit better, maybe, because the demand is there. But nothing out there is really any good at under $100. Well, get ready, because Intel, if it can make chips inexpensive enough, and it wants to, is going to power this. You know, right now, Intel's mobile chips cost about $60. You're not going to make a $100 tablet when the chip alone is a $60. But if Intel can make less expensive $5 chips, and the words that you're going to hear is good enough. It's not like this is a great tablet or this is a wonderful tablet. It's just good enough. Good enough for people who don't have a lot of money. Good enough for people who don't need more, who don't need a $500 iPad. And I, for one, I think this is great. It means more people have access to the internet, more people have access to technology, to software, to apps. Will it be Android? Well, that's the interesting thing. Android can run on Intel, but it's not designed for Intel. It's designed for ARM chips. Same with iOS. It will probably be a desktop operating system modified for this Intel chip, or maybe something else based on Linux. That's what I'm very interested in. You know what? We're going to find out soon enough, because Intel is saying by Christmas, they expect a flood of these. Now, the nice thing about this for me is I can get them and review them for you because they're cheap. So I will. I have yet to see a good tablet for under $100. The touch screen, the processor, the memory, all of that stuff costs money. But remember the revolution, the microprocessor revolution that we're benefiting from. The computers, technology has gotten smaller. Computers have gotten faster. The prices have dropped. Usually you don't get all three, right, in a car or in a house or in any durable good. But in a computer, yeah. Better, faster, and cheaper. And I think we're going to see the same thing happen. I mean, can you get to free? I guess you might be able to. That's the next step. If you can get them below $100, then companies like Google and Amazon that make their money not from the sale of the hardware, but when you use the hardware to buy Amazon books or movies or TV shows, to buy music, TV shows, books from Google, to see Google advertising, those companies could subsidize tablets to the point where they literally are free. Wow. This is a computer revolution, and it's not on the desktop. It's in your pocket. It's in bed. It's watching TV. It's wherever you have that little screen. And Intel wants to be there. This is going to be a very exciting next few years. All right, we're going to take a break. I got to get to your calls. I got a lot of great people lined up, so let me add them. Your calls are next. Leo Laporte, I am the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Time to take calls. More calls. And very patiently, George has been just sitting there in Barrow County, Georgia, waiting for me to shut up. Thank you for your patience, George. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Leo. Great job, as always.
Thank you.
My wife has a six-year-old white MacBook, and she loves photography. She's been chronicling the lives of our seven-year-old for since birth, literally.
You're so lucky. You're so lucky to have that.
And we have 700 gigs of pictures and growing. She loves nature too.
She does. And now what she needs to learn to do is cull.
Well, yeah, you tell her that.
This is the hardest thing. No, I'm sympathetic because it's very hard, but it almost has to become an obsession or a habit where when you come back from a shoot, you know, at the end of the day, you load all that stuff into Lightroom or Aperture or iPhoto, whatever you use, and you go through it and you delete all but the good shots, because there's a lot, you know. But the problem is she's never done that, so now she's really in trouble.
And it's growing.
And so it's getting bigger.
I've been updating the MacBook with a new hard drive every couple of years, and we're up to 750 gigs, and it's too small now.
Yeah.
We want to get her a new MacBook.
Well, she keeps it all on her MacBook, too. That's the other thing, is don't keep it all on the internal drive. Start moving stuff off.
We have backups, but
yeah,
she likes to keep it all there. So that's the kind of problem we're facing, because if the new Apple laptops have these small hard drives.
Well, here's what I do, and I know it's kind of a pain. It kind of makes a laptop not quite so portable. But I, in fact, never put anything but the current crop of pictures, which in my case is usually this year's pictures, on the internal drive, and as soon as the year ends, I move everything off onto an external drive. I keep the external drive connected so I can still see the pictures.
Uh-huh.
But that's really the right way to do it. And actually, the right way to do it is to cull, is to get, because there's, I guarantee you, in that 750 terabytes or gigabytes of stuff, half of it is out of focus, blurry, you know, not so interesting, or copies of, you know, duplicates of, you know, essentially the same shot.
Would a USB 3.0 or Thunderbolt drive be fast enough for her to kind of?
It won't work on your. Or, it won't work on that old computer. You need a new computer.
No, that's why a new computer with a USB 3.0.
Oh yeah.
3.0 or Thunderbolt.
So does she? What does she use? Does she use Aperture? Or does she use iPhoto? What does she use?
Well, she has moved away from Aperture because we're waiting for an update, and we're worried that Apple will never update. So she moved it all to Lightroom.
Good. Lightroom is being updated a very regular clip. It's up to 5 now. I love it. In fact, 5 has now smart folders and the ability to have offline photos. Lightroom is designed exactly. Look, her situation is no different than any other photographers. You take a lot more pictures than you want. If you don't get around to throwing them out, as I don't and a lot of others don't, then you've got a lot more pictures than you need. But Lightroom will catalog them all. You can keep the catalog, and I would, on the local drive.
Mm-hmm.
Let Lightroom make the backup on the catalog on the external drive. Here's what I would do. Here's what I do, actually. So I get back from a shoot. I've got an SD card. I import it all into Lightroom. I keep this year's photos, as I said, on my internal drive, even with a 250 gig drive, which is really kind of the max SSD. That's fine.
Yeah.
You know, that means you're going to have maybe 50 or 60 gigs of photos by the end of the year. I also have an external drive, Thunderbolt. You don't need to go Thunderbolt. USB 3 is more than fast enough.
Oh, that's great. That's great.
A USB 3. Yeah. When what I do is I buy two. So I keep them in sync. So when I travel, for instance, this is when it's most critical. Uh-huh. I don't want to lose anything. I will copy the stuff onto the main hard drive. I keep it on the SD card until I need to reuse it. So that way, don't be in a hurry to erase the SD card until you reuse it. It's kind of just a safety feature. Now I've got them on the drive. I run a backup program that keeps also the 2013 pictures on the external drive where all my pictures are. And it's not a big deal to have a terabyte external drive or more.
Yes, yes.
In fact, I'd get two.
Mm-hmm.
And that way, every once in a while, I'll sync the two. And when I come home, I'll take one and put it in my carry-on, one and put it on my checked luggage, keep my laptop close to my body at all times, and hope I'm going to make it home with all of those images. So she needs to come up with a strategy for all of this, because it's not going to, the kids are only seven. You got a long way to go.
And Apple doesn't seem to allow me to, upgrade that hard drive anymore. And
no.
To move her to a desktop Windows, and I would put a 3 terabyte hard drive in there. And
no, I think what you're doing is fine. She wants a laptop, and I think it's fine.
Yeah.
This is my compromise, because I use a MacBook Air. And I like the idea of portability. So that I just keep the current photos that I'm working on there.
Okay.
And I think that really solves the problem. Just make sure she – it sounds like you are doing this. She's backing up. I would recommend also, my friend Peter Krog wrote a book called The Digital Asset Management, or DAM book, that every photographer should read. He also has a website that he's done with the Library of Congress and the Association of Professional Photographers, the ASMP. It's called DB – Best Flow, as in workflow, DP, I should say, as in digital photography.
Okay.
Bestflow.org, because it's a nonprofit. And this is a site devoted to exactly these issues. You're a photographer. You're taking great pictures. What do you do to keep them safe? What are the best practices for workflow? And he talks about it all. And he's a Lightroom guy, so it'll have a lot of Lightroom information.
Yeah, she has an Aperture library, and then she has a Lightroom library. So
yeah, time to export the
more recent.
Yeah, time to export the photos out of the Aperture library into the Lightroom. So you have everything in your catalog.
But she loses the metadata, doesn't she? The little tweak she made, she just will have the raw file.
Yeah, but so don't throw out Aperture.
No, we're not.
Do copy it over, I think. Yeah.
Okay.
That way she'll have all of her photos there. Aperture's great, but you're right. Apple hasn't updated it. Well, they've updated it, but they haven't done a new version since 2010.
Yeah.
It's almost 3 years. And golly, I think they will, but you can't count on Apple anymore for any of this stuff. Unfortunately, it breaks my heart. But yeah. You just can't count on them. I think she's right to move to Lightroom. Adobe is very much dedicated to Lightroom in the time that they've done 3 versions of Lightroom in the time that Aperture has been updated.
Yes. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Great call.
You're doing great work, okay?
All right. Hey, thanks for the call. I really appreciate it. Great, very good questions. I hope I didn't go over your head too much. If you're just doing a point-and-shoot photography, maybe these aren't an issue. But I think they are in a way, because don't you want to save all your stuff? You don't want to lose your stuff. Yeah, when Aperture exports, if you use Aperture's export, it will export JPEGs of the modified images. Think about your own, print pictures from your childhood before this digital stuff came along. How many pictures total? I'm old enough that all of the pictures of my childhood and even young adulthood are either slides or prints. And total, all the pictures I remember and value and think about number well under 1,000. Do you really want your kids to have 150,000 pictures to look through? They're not going to look through them. Help them. Narrow it down. Edit. Some people say save everything. I don't think so. 8888 Ask Leo. Let's have some more in just a bit. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Phone calls, they're pouring in. Let's talk to Graham, Townsend, Massachusetts. Hello, Graham.
Hi, Leo. How you doing?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. I kind of met you. I was at Disneyland with my family around Christmas time before you switched over to one episode, and you were doing 5 episodes at a time.
Oh, wow. That was a couple of years ago.
And we were there when you and Leo recorded 7 episodes.
Dick DiBartolo, or... crazy guy, Mad Magazine writer for 5 decades, and we do a gadget show called The Gizwiz. You must be a fan.
Actually, I think I learned about Dick when you were talking about it on this show.
Isn't it?
Episode 1.
Isn't it great that Dick is such a sweetheart? Here he is in Manhattan. He lets people come over, visit him, hang out while he's doing the show. That is just amazing.
Yeah, it's really sweet.
I hope your kids enjoyed it.
Oh, we had a great time. My daughter's a geek. My son just enjoyed the humor and having a great time there. So it was wonderful.
I'll never forget bringing my daughter, who was maybe 12 at the time, to New York to visit with Dick, and he took us to Mad Magazine's office, and we looked at the original art, and it was so incredible.
Yeah, I'm hoping to get there sometime.
Yeah, great. He is a sweet guy. Well, anyway, what can I do for you?
I have got a Samsung Fascinate, which I think was way ahead of its time. The screen is gorgeous.
Fascinating.
Still is.
Yes.
And I'm looking to get a new phone or considering it. And so I've discovered that I am a one-hand cell phone user. I pull it out of the holster in my back, and I use the thumb to pretty much navigate through it. And so I tried my wife's Samsung Galaxy S3.
It's too big.
It is.
All right, I got the phone for you. What carrier are you on?
Verizon.
Okay, good. Moto X.
Oh, really?
Absolutely, without hesitation. So in fact, to some people, this feels too small. But they were one of the things they paid a lot of attention to. Motorola did was one hand operation, and so it is 4.7 inches, but it is, you'll feel immediately that it feels much more compact than any modern phone. And I have short, stubby fingers, no problem reaching the whole thing, typing with my thumb, all of that. This is a really elegant phone. Highly recommended.
Have you found like the S3s and S4 to be tough also for you?
No, because I'm a two-handed guy.
That's exactly what I'm wondering is, do I still go with one hand or do I start doing
it? No, if you want, no, do it. Hey, it's your phone. You get to do it any way you want.
But I'm considering if I should get a Note 2.
I'm not crazy about it. I am kind of off Samsung because the Galaxy S4 has so much cruft on it, so much of Samsung software that you'll never use, and it's loaded up with it. You can't get rid of it. It takes up a lot of space, and I just feel like it's too much. So if you want to look at a high-end phone, Verizon now has the HTC One. I think that's excellent. But while you're in the Verizon store, please do me a favor. Pick up the Moto X. There's something about this phone. It reminds me of the first of a few iPhones where it just feels friendly.
And what's the size of the HTC One compared to that?
The One is a same size screen, 4.7 inches, but it's bigger because it's got speakers on the front.
Okay.
And it feels a little bit bigger, but the One is elegant. It's aluminum unibody. It is just a gorgeous phone. I think the speakers in the front are a big selling point. The One has probably the best camera. The negative on the Moto X is it does not have a good camera.
Okay.
Not bad. It's not horrible. It's just kind of middle of the road.
So those are probably the two for me to compare.
I would. And then, you know, I guess Verizon has some Windows phones you could look at, but I think they feel bigger. They just feel big. And I guess the 5, you know, you should look at the 5S, the iPhone. It's weird to me because it's tall and thin. And they say one-handed operation, but, you know, you can't get your thumb to the top of the screen. It's too far.
Yeah, I hate that.
Look at the Moto X. I'm telling you, it feels the best in the hand of any phone I've ever used.
Great.
Hey, thanks for the call. I appreciate it.
All right. Thanks, Ellie.
Take care. Peter in, I almost said Broccoli, New York. Brooklyn, New York. Hi, Peter.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Pretty good, thank you. Leo, I had a question. I was thinking of either getting, like you said, the Moto X.
Yeah.
Or maybe waiting for the Galaxy Note 3.
Yeah, that'll be out soon. That'll be out in the next couple of weeks. But they're very different phones. Their Note 3 is ginormous.
They announced on the 4th, right?
Yeah, they announced on the 4th, and it'll be end of this month. Like any day now. But it's huge. It's these phones are not related. The only thing in common is they both run Android.
Right.
I mean, it really depends on how big a phone. Do you want a big? I like big screens. I'm absolutely going to look at the Note when it's available. The Moto X is not going to appeal to somebody who wants a big phone. It's a small phone. Even though it's 4.7 inches, it feels like a small phone. It's only 720p. It's not a super high-resolution screen. You get the Moto X is more, I think, is designed for people who are not into phones. Are not like, oh, let's see, what's the greatest? How big can the screen be? How high resolution? Oh, my God. It's not for that. It's for people who just want a smartphone that really gets the job done. So are you kind of, another one you should look into is the Optimus G2, which I think, I don't know if anybody's got that now, but it should be very soon. That is maybe next month. That is the big phone that just came out from LG, and a lot of people who've played with that love it. Are you looking for a big phone?
Leo, I usually use like the iPhone for one carrier, and then my work phone, I usually use a bigger phone.
I
had the Note 1 and then the Note 2 I had. I like them. But I recently actually switched the Note 2 out and I went to the S4. But like you said, it was very bloatware.
Boy, and I think the Note 3 will be the same. On the other hand, do you like the stylus? Because that's the selling point on the Note, is the stylus.
To tell you the truth, Leo, I never use it. I have pretty big hands.
Yeah, me neither. So and I'm no artist. And what am I going to do with a stylus? What? So, no, I that's exactly right. I think the S4 is a better choice unless you need the stylus. But it's so crufted up. It's so junked up. It's really a shame that Samsung. I think they've moved in the direction of being all things to all people. And I don't like that. I don't think that's right. The Moto X is a very clean, simple phone. There's only a couple of carrier apps on it. I have the AT&T version. It has two applications from Motorola and two applications from AT&T, and in almost every other respect, it is a pure Google phone. Clean, simple, it really works nice. I highly recommend it.
Okay. Thank you very much, Leo. I appreciate
you're
it.
You're welcome. I'm glad you called. It's not a phone for the phone enthusiasts. We're seeing now this, and this is, you know, this has always been the case with technology. There's a real line between normal people who just want to use it and get stuff done, and people like me who like, and I would guess you, who like really into, oh, what are the specs? How big is it? Well, you know, is it the most beautiful in the world? What is it? You know, and the Moto X is not for that crowd. It is for the people who want a simple phone that works well, that has some very nice features. I really like it. They finally released the Clip, which I saw a couple of months ago and thought was cool. It's got an NFC chip in it and a magnet. And you swipe the phone. You can have it unlock. You swipe it and unlocks it, and it's ready to use. Just, I like it. But enough about that. Time to take a break. We'll have more in just a bit. Our final segment of the day coming up. Don't forget the website, techguylabs.com. I'm Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy, Dominic Bloomingdale in Illinois. Hey, Dominic, how are you? Leo Laporte here.
Good. Actually, I'm a longtime listener. Most of Twitch shows I listen to, a good majority of them are each week.
Yay.
But my real question is, I mean, you always stress back up and whatnot. I mean, you always suggest Carbonite, that being your sponsor also.
Yep.
But I've been backing or archiving all my DVD collection for a couple of years, and I'm at about 10 terabytes of movies and TV shows.
So this is a very important thing. As much as I like Carbonite, it's really not good for anything more than maybe 100 or 200 gigabytes. I mean, you can store as much as you want. It's not the issue. The issue is, how much time do you have? How many terabytes? You said 9 terabytes? Do some math. You know, I'm gonna just. I don't know if I can do this in real time because I'm not so good at math. But let's say, what is your upstream bandwidth? You know, I mean,
good day 12 megabits.
12 megabits up. That's very fast. That's unusually fast. You must have FiOS or something like that.
No, just Comcast Blast.
Ah, well, there's an important thing about Blast. Blast is fast for the first few seconds and then slows way down. So you want to know what your sustained throughput is, because that's what's going to matter. Chances are 10 terabytes of data would take you years to copy.
Or Comcast will just cut me off, right?
Yeah, or they'd cut you off. It's really not practicable to upload more than a few hundred gigabytes to an offline server. But that doesn't mean you shouldn't have an off-site backup. It's probably not going to be in the cloud. You don't want to pay for 10 terabytes of storage either, for that matter.
That's also the next cost issue with that, too. And then having to restore it ever, God forbid.
Yeah, well, exactly. So this is a case for hard drives. My friend Alex Lindsay, who does a lot of video production, you might know him. He's a regular on our Mac Break Weekly show, our show about Macintosh. Great guy. Does a ton of video production, which means, and when you do video production, you've got lots of data. You may have 10 terabytes for one show. So what does he do? He buys hard drives in bulk. Fills them up, wraps them in bubble wrap, puts them in a closet. That's his backup. He doesn't ever erase a hard drive. or delete a file. He just takes them out and puts new ones in. So every project, there might be 3 or 4, and this is true in Hollywood too, there might be 3 or 4 hard drives associated with that project. Hard drives are relatively cheap. I mean, you know, if you're doing it, if this is your business, to spend $400 on storage is not a big deal. If, you know, you obviously care a lot about these DVDs.
Yeah, because I do is I put them on my Plex server.
Oh, that's neat. So yeah. They're all available to you.
So that's kind of
how many movies is that? That's like 10. That's like 1,000 movies, right?
I'm at 2,500 movies, and then 60 different TV show series, like The Simpsons 1 through 25. And
now, see, that's valuable because you can't get that on DVD. You can't get all The Simpsons series. Season 4, their greatest. Is it season 4, season 5? One of their greatest series, you can't get it. So you're lucky. You got all 25 years of The Simpsons. Holy cow.
Varying quality. But, yes, I have all of that.
Yeah. Well, I would absolutely. You're going to have to buy hard drives, copy it onto hard drives, wrap them in non-static. You know, the bag that came in is actually a pretty good one. That Mylar bag, that's an anti-static bag. Wrap it in that. Put it in a cardboard box. Put it in a closet and hope you never need to access it. Best would be somewhere out of your house, at work, storage locker, somewhere where, you know, if the house burns down, it's not likely that the rest of it burns down.
Yeah, it sounds like my best option because yeah. I looked everywhere else.
It's by far your most economical, and it's frankly the only way to do it. Yeah, Carbonite says unlimited backup, but let's be realistic. I mean, you can't. 10 terabytes, that'd be ridiculous.
Yeah, that'd be just an ungodly amount.
And hard drives don't last forever, but they, unused, in a closet, kept at a normal temperature, not a lot of extremes of heat and cold, no moisture, they're going to probably last a good long time. I mean, look, they're going to last longer than you and me, in all likelihood. Hey, thanks for the call, Dominic. I appreciate it. We do the ad for Carbonite. I love Carbonite, but it is, from time to time, it's worth mentioning. This is not a practical solution for massive amounts of data. For that, you really need some sort of physical storage. Jackie in New York, Leo Laporte, the
Hello.
Tech guy. Hi, Jackie.
Hi, Mr. Laporte. Thank you for taking my call.
Well, thank you for calling.
I am trying to make a decision for our family. We have an old main PC. It's a XP, which is going to not be supported shortly. And so I'm making the decision whether to switch from a Windows system to an iMac. I'm looking at I want to put in a good system, and doing some reviews of some of the magazines and the journals, it seems to come down to an iMac versus something like the Dell XPS all-in-one.
Which are very similar, and I'm not going to take a position on Windows versus Macintosh. I happen to prefer Macintosh, but that's really a matter of taste. There's not that much difference.
Well, that's the point. My kids are 9 and 10. They're getting into they're just starting to get into the deep computer period. And I want them to actually to be conversant and comfortable with both systems because
don't worry.
Okay.
First of all, it's not going to look like that in 10 years. Second of all, yes. Kids are just natural. The most important thing at this point is for them to be able to use it, be comfortable with it, not be afraid of it, and to be able to use the internet, be able to use search engines, and to have the critical faculties to understand that what they read on the internet isn't always true, and to be able to weigh what's true and not. Those are all skills that will hold them in good stead. Whether you can use Microsoft Word is not going to be a big deal.
Right. The problem is that the decision becomes intangible. It's
totally intangible.
Difficult.
I'll tell you, here's what you really need to know.
Okay.
You can buy cheap computers, don't.
Oh, I don't want to buy a cheap computer.
Yeah, no, but that's what I'm saying. This is all you need to know. Don't buy business grade, hardware. All Macs are business grade. They don't sell an inexpensive Mac. They don't.
Right.
Not all PCs are business grade. A lot of PCs you see in the store are crap.
Right.
And they're people are price sensitive, and so they want to HP and Dell and Lenovo and everybody wants to offer something inexpensive, but you get what you pay for.
Yeah, no, I have no intention of buying a cheap computer. The issue is, you know, some of the, you know, big magazines were recommending the Dell, but with Dell's issues, I was a little concerned.
Yeah, Dell's in play right now. They're trying to figure out who's going to own it.
That's my concern, although their machine is ranked as one of the highest ones.
Yeah, I love the Dell XPS, the Dell One, the all-in-one that looks like a Mac. It's beautiful. I like it a lot.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I was looking at.
It's functionally similar. Now, there's something. One thing to keep in mind is that only Macs can run both OS X and Windows.
That's exactly right. And in the last few years, I've gotten more comfortable. Like, I actually kind of entered tech through my phone, Android, and I started learning how to use my computer because I wanted to root and manage my phone. And so now I'm much more comfortable playing around.
You're a geek.
I feel comfortable like I would be able to dual boot, you know, the iMac.
It's easy.
And therefore I could put games for my son when he's a little bit older and wants something that would need a Windows system.
That's right.
So
I would get, you know what, I'm just going to save you a lot of angst.
Do that, please.
I'm going to cut through all of this. I have in front of me right now, and I just love it. This is the the kind of the razor thin iMac. It's the current Mac sold by Apple. iMac sold by Apple. It's gorgeous. Yeah. It's got a great screen. It's elegant. Yeah. It does everything you want. It's easy to put Windows on it if that's what you need. Yeah. I bet you won't until your son becomes a gamer.
Well, he's getting there. He's starting with Minecraft.
Well, Minecraft will work fine on a Mac. He doesn't need anything.
Does it? Okay, good. Yeah. Great.
And I just think this is just an elegant, nice machine. I'm expressing my prejudices a little bit, but that's what I like, and that's what I would say get if I were you.
Well, you know, I that was my inclination, but because my history has always been Windows, I figured I should at least explore. And so I appreciate.
I think Microsoft's taken a little bit of a wrong turn with Windows 8, and I think it's a little frustrating, and I'm not sure it's the right thing. Whereas OS X is great. You have, if your son gets to be like serious about programming, it comes with programming languages. You have a Unix command line on the thing. It's elegant.
Yeah, I think that's probably the way we're going to go. And I did want to actually thank you for one other thing. I listened to your interview with Esther Dyson.
Oh, she's great.
She mentioned a website for teaching kids to code. I think it was, I forget the name right now, irene.org or something like that.
Yeah.
I went there and I loaded it.
It's Alice.
And I couldn't get it to load. And I sent an email to the, and they were wonderful. It was Carnegie Mellon. They sent me an email immediately how to
it's load great, it. Isn't it?
And my daughter's starting to play with it.
I have to run, but alice.org, you're absolutely right. And you're doing the best thing you can for your kids. I think that's fabulous. Hey, we're out of time. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. Have a great geek week. Well, that's it for the Tech Guy show for today. I'm Leo Laporte. Thank you so much for joining us. Don't forget, the Tech Guy is just the tip of the iceberg. We do nearly 30 shows now on the Twit Netcast Network, and you'll find them all at twit.tv. We talk about Windows and Windows Weekly, Macintosh and MacBreak Weekly, iPad and iPad Today. You get your daily dose of tech news from Tech News Today and our weekly roundtable show, This Week in Tech. It's all at twit.tv. And I'll be back next time with another great Tech Guy podcast. Thanks for joining me. See you next time.